So, as I was saying last week, on this question of universal history, I'd actually begun an investigation back maybe a month ago, or a continuing investigation into Venice and the history of Venice, because this is a really crucial element of the last 2,000 years that most people are not really familiar with. So I wanted to do a presentation on that. Now, tonight will be just a little bit of a teaser, and maybe next Thursday, I'll talk with the others, do the actual full exposition on the evil of Venice. But I was reading a story by Friedrich Schiller, this guy here, who's a very important German poet, who's known actually as the poet of freedom. And Friedrich Schiller wrote, who I also mentioned last week, he was a history professor, a dramatist, poet, and a philosopher. He was many things. But he wrote probably the strangest piece out of everything that he did, and the one that kind of stands apart from everything else, a book called The Ghost Seer. And it's strange because it's actually a profound study of what we refer to as the Venetian method, that is epistemological warfare. Now, what is epistemological warfare? it's what you see in the streets, actually, today. What you see all the time in our culture, although you probably don't understand it, is that epistemology, you could say, is the study of knowledge and how you know things. This is one of the areas that Plato was very interested in. Now, why is that of importance? And why would Venice be have chosen this area to develop an unbelievable expertise? Now, just to give you a little background on Venice here. So maybe we'll douse the lights for a couple of minutes. I just have a couple of slides I want to show, and then we'll get on to some other things. And then we'll get into some geometry. Now, Venice is this city here, Venezia. Okay, and you see the purple lines are the trade roads that Venice had throughout the Mediterranean. Now, when I found this map, I wasn't exactly sure. It didn't say the date explicitly for when this was, but you could say in general terms, from 1000 until 1600 or 1700, this would have been the type of trade roads. Now, Genoa, its main competition is here. Venice and Genoa fought a lot of wars against each other over the years. Sometimes Venice would win, other times Genoa would win. And when they would win, they would exclude each other from different areas of trade and things like that. But you can see also the road systems of Europe. Now, one of the key things about Venice is that all of Europe, to go to the east, and you'll notice here, key ports like Tripoli into the Ottoman Empire, really the only, in some cases, Venice would have a monopoly on trade with the Ottoman Empire and further east into China. Venice was the center of the bullion trade. So most of the coins in Europe were minted in Venice. All kinds of things like this, which I'll get into more next week. But from about 800 until 1700 AD, Venice was the single most important financial and intelligence center in Europe. It was the place where everyone in Europe would come if they wanted to know what was going on anywhere else.
Sorry, can you repeat the dates?
From about 800 AD until 1700, Venice was the primary financial and intelligence center in Europe. And as the Byzantine Empire crumbled and collapsed towards 1453, Venice became the... in a sense, Venice just took over the Byzantine Empire. But we'll deal with that more next week. But it was very, very important, even though it just seems like a small city. Similarly to the way the British Empire, although a small island, becomes this global power. And through its maritime trade, its naval power, and its control of international finance, comes to dominate the entire world economy. Okay? because the British Empire, as we'll get into next week, is actually modeled on the Venetian Empire. It's not modeled on Rome. So this is what Venice looks like from the air. Kind of interesting. It's built in a swamp. Well, they call it a lagoon, but it's really a swamp, which is lawful, considering the creatures that came out of it. The idea was it was a mile offshore, and around it was founded officially in, I think, 425 A.D. by a bunch of fleeing Roman nobles and noble families, and probably others from the area that they gathered to them, as Rome as the Western Roman Empire was collapsing, and they chose Venice because you had these lagoons up in here. Rome was very exposed. Once the defenses of the empire in France and Germany collapsed. But Venice here is a mile offshore. And it was really unapproachable by any of the barbarian armies that were invading at the time over the next couple centuries because they were barbarians. They really didn't have any capacity for naval warfare or anything like that. So the Venetian, these families that moved there were safe. And then over time they became the center of the slave trade also. They would enslave Christians and sell them to the Ottomans and things like that. So they were not against enslaving their own people. But of course, the Venetians were never really Christians either. So this is what Venice looks like in the evening. It's a very exotic city. It has this mystery about it, which endures to this day. And it was always known as being more Eastern than Western. And you see it in some of the architecture. There's a picture of the main church a bit later. Now, Carnival. It's a very famous festival that went on for a long period of time. I think it was just before Lent, or just after. I'll check that up for next week. But the idea being, you just go crazy, partying all the time. And at a certain point, people started wearing masks, because then you could do whatever you wanted and not be nobody would know who it was. So, because Venice was not exactly known for its moral, yeah, and it became a real center of debauchery and promiscuity and many other things. So people would go around dressed up like this, and it would just be a giant, well, you know, let your imagination run wild, and that's what was going on. Okay, so this is the type of culture you have. This is an interesting painting called the Bravo. Now, it's blown up a lot, so it's not the best quality, but what you have here, you have this fellow turning around. He's got a very interesting look on his face, right? Startled. He has a wreath of laurels on his head, so he may be some member of a royal family. But now, this guy here, you can just make out his face a bit. But you notice something about this guy?
Or a wine bottle.
Down in here. Well, it's pretty clearly in there. You see the handle. A pogo stick, yeah. So what's he about to do? The Bravo, that was a name given to assassins.
It's probably
in Venice.
Slash his throat.
He's a diminishing political position.
Killer for hire?
Yeah.
Collateral damage.
This is painted by a Venetian painter named Titian. Actually, there's a book written by a very important American patriot named James Fenimore Cooper. The book's called The Bravo. And I'm itching to get my fingers on a copy because I want to read that. And it's a similar kind of... Now, this is curious. At this point, I just want to mention one thing. Because, again, the reputation of Venice... Shakespeare writes two plays, very, very important, The Merchant of Venice and Othello, the Moor of Venice. If you read these plays, you know, you'll see Venice is always portrayed with a very clear, in a very clear way, manipulation, deceit, double-crossing, intrigue, the whole thing, games of empire. Schiller writes his book, The Ghost Seer. Fenimore Cooper writes The Bravo, all of them, it's the same thing. You know, so this should tell you something about how Venice was understood. maybe not by the average Joe peasant, but by the people who were engaged in these more profound battles over the fate of humanity, as the type of battle we're involved in today, understood very clearly what Venice was. Because the type of mindset that, say, Schiller would have to write this, and the way he writes it, it's clear that he's not just writing it to write a suspense or a thriller like people today would write this stuff. Now, the winged lion of St. Mark. This is the symbol of Venice. The winged lion. It's supposed to be a symbol of you know, the apostle, St. Mark. However, now this says, Pax tibi Marque Evangelista Meus. So, peace be to you, Mark, the apostle, the evangelist, my evangelist. That's Venice in the background. However, and you'll see, you know, it's all over Venice, this winged lion. This is kind of an interesting picture here. But it's ambiguous because, you know, the winged lion is not just a symbol of St. Mark. It comes from the East.
Is it a lion?
Well, they had it. It's the lion's body with the wings and the head of a human being.
It's actually a sphinx, but it's mm-hmm. the same idea.
The same idea. But, now that could seem like just an assertion that I'm making, that the connection is not to St. Mark, actually, but this kind of pagan, Eastern, cult-like religion. But once you study Venice more clearly and you study the methodology of Venice, its history, it becomes very clear that the Venetians were not Christians. So, and you see with the Basilica of St. Mark, this is actually where the largest hoard of wealth potentially in history was stored. This is the main church in Venice. And the procurators of San Marco were the most powerful individuals in Venice. You had to be a you had to be a procurator before, which is like a caretaker of the church, before you could be a doge. And the procurators were only, you only had like a half dozen families out of all the ruling families of Venice that would become procurators. But you notice it's very Eastern. It's a very Eastern. So the point I'm trying to make is that to give you a sense of Venice. Now, this actually is a picture of a portion of the wall of the Doge's palace. Now, if you can read what it says below the hideous-looking face, it says, Denuncie Secrete. And then a bunch of other stuff that I don't understand. But I see Occultera, I see Contro. What it means is for secret denunciations. So anybody in Venice could come and could slip a paper through the mouth to denounce a friend, an associate, for treason against the state. And those denunciations would go directly to a body called the Council of Ten, or the State Inquisitors, who ruled Venice with an iron fist, and they could issue a death sentence at will, no appeal, and all you would hear is the body being found in one of the canals the next morning. So they wielded, it was an absolute police state. You didn't know who was an informant, who wasn't. You know, so you didn't talk politics, even with your best friend. So it's interesting that in Venice, for its entire history, never suffered a coup or internal strife. That's why they called it the Serenissima Repubblica, the most serene republic. Mm. But it wasn't a republic.
Was it serene?
Well, I'm not sure it was serene.
Not at night.
So this is a bit of Venice. And that's all I wanted to show this evening on that. Now, so hopefully at least from that you get just you get a flavor of what this culture is all about. And we can turn that off now too.
Yeah.
I don't know where the it's just right there. Okay. So it's a very mysterious thing, and we're going to flesh this out more next week because I mean it's already getting late, and I don't want to dwell on this a huge amount. But the question of epistemological warfare, how do you know what you know? And what is possible for somebody, or say in this case, with this story, the people that are running Venice, to do to individuals in that city whose ideas and beliefs are based on something very insubstantial? Or like today, you live in a culture where people can't really tell you why they believe what they believe. They can't give you any rigorous system of ideas and principles upon which they base their assertions. It's really just, it's all pie in the sky when it comes down to it. They've accumulated a set of beliefs and opinions over their lifetime, but what is it grounded in? Right? Now, if that is the state of mind of a person, they can be very easily manipulated. Because how do you actually know then what's true and what's not? This is very important. Because what happens in this story, and you know, I encourage people to read it because it's very useful. Because you know, you start reading this thing, and you're told straight off the bat, this is a story of intrigue and deception, and things, you know, I shall relate an affair that will appear incredible to many. You know, and it goes on. But no matter how prepared you are for the unbelievable, you get to the end, and the ending of the story is so out of the blue, you realize that, okay, I just read this, but I don't know what the hell just went on. Because nothing is what it appears. But you read it a second time and you say, holy shit, how this thing is managed. Now, what goes on in here? You have a prince from a major kingdom in Germany. And at the time, there was actually thoughts of the Jesuits and being implicated in various political intrigues over the throne of Württemberg, I guess one of the German principalities. And Schiller wrote this book around the same time. So this prince is third in line for the throne of Württemberg. And he's brought in, and through a series of manipulations, which start with a mysterious Armenian, okay? He's taken through a series of events which pass back and forth from the natural to the supernatural, in a sense. And I just want to read, I'm not going to go through this whole thing, but I want to read a couple paragraphs here. This is told by a friend of the prince who was around him a fair bit. He says, the prince lived strictly incognito because he wanted to come and go as he pleased in Venice, and because his meager allowance would not have permitted him to live as high as would befit his state. Two knights whose silence he could entirely count upon, and a few loyal servants were all that attended him. He avoided pomp, more out of temperament than frugality. He kept distance from diversions. At the age of 35, he had resisted all of the enticements of this city of temptations. He had been totally indifferent to the fair sex up to now. A deep seriousness and eccentric melancholy shaped his disposition. His inclinations were gentle, but he was stubborn to the extreme. Slow and diffident in choosing acquaintances, he was warm and eternal in his fidelity. Amidst a clamorous crowd, he found his way alone, shut off in the world of his imagination. He was often a stranger in the real one. There is never one more born to be ruled than he, although he was not weak. He was nevertheless intrepid and reliable, as soon as he had been won over, and was equally disposed to do battle against an acknowledged prejudice, or to die for another one. Being the third prince of his house, there was hardly any prospect that he would rule one day. His ambition had never been awakened, and so his passions had taken other directions. Content not to be dependent upon a will other than his own, he felt no temptation to rule over others. The quiet freedom of private life and enjoyment of a lively intellectual company were the utmost of his desires. He read a good deal, but without being selective. An education neglected, and early military service had not permitted his mind to mature. All of the knowledge he accumulated later only increased the confusion of his conceptions, because they had not been built on firm foundations. He was a Protestant by birth, as was his entire family, albeit his convictions were not the result of inquiries. These he had never made, though at one point in his life he had been a religious fanatic. As far as I know, he never became a Freemason. Okay, so that's the prince. Now the key point, his conceptions had not been built on firm foundations. Now, being in line for the throne, he's walking through the square of San Marco outside of this church. He sits down with his friend on a bench. And this man approaches, who appears to be an Armenian, and sits down beside the prince without saying a word. And a few awkward moments pass. And then the prince says, "Well, it's 9 o'clock. Let's get out of here." And the Armenian looks over and says, "Good luck, prince." And he uses his full name. This is a complete stranger. Now, we don't, you know, he puts a star in for the name of the prince, but it's implied that, so good luck, Prince so-and-so. He died at 9 o'clock. Then the Armenian stands up and disappears. Not like in a puff of smoke, but into the crowd. And this is how the book begins, the story begins. Total.
Who died? Prince?
Good question. Not the prince. The prince is still there. 6 days later, the prince, again walking through the square, a friend, an acquaintance comes up and says, "I have a letter for you." He reads it, and he finds out that the person before him in line to the throne had died 6 days previously at 9 o'clock. Totally blown away. You know, and doesn't... What the hell? Because the whole time the prince had been going, what is up with this Armenian? What is up with this guy and what's going on? Finds out somehow he had this foreknowledge, this magical foreknowledge of the death of this person, right? And it's off. And he goes through a series of these kinds of very shocking events, you know, that culminate in a seance where he, you know, he's got this crazy entourage of people and they get into this kind of Freemasonic ritual of summoning a spirit of a dead associate of the prince. And in the middle of this seance, where the you've got this apparition on the wall and it's apparently speaking to the group, and all of a sudden the door bursts open and this other spirit comes raging in, and the summoner, or the apparitionist who had summoned the first spirit, freaks out and is screaming. And then all of a sudden, in the midst of this, it's discovered that one of the members of the prince's entourage was the Armenian. And a moment later you find out that he's actually working on behalf of the Venetian State Inquisition. You know, like, this is what's going on, you know. It's just, it's a roller coaster, and you're just wondering, holy shit, what the hell is going on? Now the prince can think through all of this. And he later, in discussions with his friend, says, okay, and he kind of dissects the whole situation and how it went down, and how the whole thing had been a hoax. How the summoning of the first spirit, and they kind of discover how the whole little operation was worked, like with they had, you know, smoke bombs and the different little tricks, you know, like a magician. You know, he seems to be doing these magical things, but in reality it's all illusions and deceptions. So the prince gets through that, and he thinks, okay, well, he's very proud of himself. Right? But in fact, even though he thinks he's in control, he's actually being played. Because the effect of this, which was known by the Armenian in this crowd, is that because his religious faith was built on such tenuous grounds, that when, and he'd been a superstitious guy, he believed in spirits and all that stuff, that this experience totally destroyed all of his faith. And over the course of the following period of time, he gets involved with some groups, just by chance, of course, that are very much libertine and laissez-faire, do whatever you want. Secret society, actually. That's what he gets indoctrinated into. And his entire faith is subverted. He takes on this like pleasure society thing, and he does a complete reversal from what he had been before. And he's drawn into this Venetian web of intrigue. And he literally loses his mind and goes from being this upright person to being, oh, but princes are to live for opinion, and if we don't have opinion, and, you know, he's got all these followers now, you know, who are, well, you know this idea of royalty and retainers and being the center of attention like our movie stars? And you can imagine the effect of all of a sudden, from being a recluse, being brought into this world of pop stardom. You know, and you begin to believe the hype. This is what happens to the prince, basically. His faith gets destroyed, and all of a sudden he's introduced into all of Venice. And a series of other things happen, but what's happening the whole time, and you know, it's... I'm not going to try to explain it, because it's... The point being, the prince has been profiled, and he's being played by Venetian intelligence to abandon not only his previous beliefs and his previous way of life, but to be turned into an agent for the interests of Venice. And by the end of the book, what he's done is broken all of his ties with his family. He's indebted himself to a bunch of Venetian usurers. He's literally lost his mind, you know, got himself into all kinds of other troubles, and is plotting the overthrow of his own family. And the narrator emphasizes several times throughout it, the problem is that his beliefs, his principles, were never based on firm foundations. So, with this kind of stuff in mind, you know, and people should just read the story, because unless you're going to do a whole class, you know, and that's what I'm realizing is, it's very, you know, you'd want to do a full class on this story to be able to do it justice. But the point is that if you don't have a solid basis in knowing how the mind works, how you know what you know, then if you come into contact with sophisticated powers and intelligence services like Venice had, or like the British use today, you're dead meat. And you're going to get played. And this is the thing, you know, you most people out there on the street these days, when you talk to them about the British Empire, they don't get it. And even, I mean, I'll admit, it took a long time before I really started to figure it out. It's not easy. Because if you base your beliefs on sense perception, you're not going to get it. Because their methods are all about manipulating you based on your belief in sense perception and seeing as believing. So, this is one of the reasons, it's not the only reason, but it's one of the reasons that we do geometry. And we do things like double the square. or solve the Pythagorean theorem. You know, not just write out the formula, but actually geometrically solve it. To investigate and base our knowledge on the firm foundations that are required to go into battle, epistemological battle against the enemy, because that's what they use. You know, just remember, I mean, just like Venice, the British army based its power, or the British empire based its power on manipulating other countries into fighting their wars for them. Just like you see with the United States today. So if you want to break out of that, you've got to be thinking on a higher level than the enemy. You know, and this is why LaRouche always emphasizes the nature of man. It always comes back to that. You got to start there. And if that's not firm, then probably nothing else will be either. So, the challenge that I want to lay out for those who dare is actually that there's a problem for, okay, for those who haven't, and maybe we want to get a few compasses, there's a couple in the back room and some paper, is to actually do some geometry. And next week we're going to learn a bit more about Venice and the history of how the Venetian Empire became the British Empire, because that's very important. But for now, I want to pose two challenges. Now, the first one is to double the square. Now, for those of you who had, I've done this already, I've got something different for you guys. But the idea, and we're going to break off at this point, and some people can help others, I guess, if they want, is to take a square of area 1 and constructively produce a square of area 2 that's knowable. Is that clear?
It has to incorporate that square as well, right?
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to incorporate it, but you can use this square, and you can manipulate the square, you can construct additional lines. You can do different things, but the key thing is that whatever you do is done in a knowable way, in a provable, demonstrable way. It is not arbitrary. Okay? And to create a square of area 2. Now, for those that have done, that are familiar and have done this before, I've got something else. And, which is to double the area of the triangle.
Oh, for us? Oh, those who already did the...
have done the square, yeah.
Does it have to be a triangle? Or? Oh, no, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Oh, it does?
Yeah.
So we do it on the board?
Well, we'll have some paper, and we'll hand out paper.
Maybe flat surfaces, too. I can get maybe some binder or something, so that you can do some stuff on the laps.
So what's the area of the triangle? 1?
Yeah, the area of the triangle is 1.
Can it be any kind of triangle?
I'm sure. You can try. Yeah, do whatever you want.
Are you going to have a presentation next week as well?
Yeah, next week I'll do the actual history on Venice, on the evil of Venice. Yeah, it's getting a bit late.
Yeah, quite a bit away.
Okay.
I'll try to do it at home, the triangle.
I think you can get the Go Seer online also.
Oh, yeah, you can.
Yeah, it's worth it. It's not that long. But,
Why is it?
He said it's a good But, yeah, okay, cool. I'll use one more. Yeah, okay, all right.
Oh, Mark, by the way, I'll get back.
So, have you ever done anything like this before? It's okay. The idea being that you want to break out of the habits that are imposed on us in school of thinking in terms of formulas. You know, they teach you a formula, and then you use it to you manipulate it, right? You're never told why it's true. Yeah, you get the whole idea. You know, and you end up going through life never having to
go. You're not an official level 1.
Things can overturn our ideas very quickly. You see that in the religious fundamentalism in the United States. In the way that society is controlled through this you know, various forms of cult beliefs. So start with the
part of the
square. You construct the square and clover, and you can use a compass if you want, but it's not really necessary. For you can solve it without it. And the idea is by using lines, you know, extending.
Now I think or the
rotation.
I think we
like
got
try to construct a like a new square, right? And to do it in a normal triangles are. And you can feel free to make mistakes. That's the whole, you can't solve it without making mistakes.
One of those funny things.